Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, April 13, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the future of telecommunications law and policy. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome three experts to our call today. This is going to be a call that will be moderated, a conversation moderated by our first guest, Brian Tramont. He's the managing partner of Wilkinson, Barker & Naur right here in Washington, D.C. He's also the former FCC chief of staff, and he's chairman of the Federalist Society's Telecommunications Executive Committee. He's going to moderate, as I suggested, this conversation between our two other guests, whom he'll introduce momentarily. And with that, Brian Tramont, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, very much. Very happy to be with you this afternoon and to welcome two experts to discuss the future of telecommunications and new administration. We're joined by Tricia Paoletta, who's a partner at the law firm of Harris, Wiltshire & Grannis here in Washington, D.C., where she specializes in telecommunications trade and technology policy, and she served on the Trump-Pence transition team as well. She has accrued considerable experience in telecommunications and trade policy. She was a senior advisor to the International Bureau Chief at the FCC. Prior to that, she served as the Director of Telecommunications Trade Policy in the Office of USTR, and previously served the Majority Counsel to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, as well as at Level 3 Communications. She's also an active member of the Federalist Society, as well as the Federal Communications Bar Association. Our second guest is Senior Counsel Nick Degani from the FCC. Prior to assuming his current role, Nick was now Chairman Pai's wireline legal advisor. Prior to that, served as counsel under Chairman Fred Upton at the House Energy and Commerce Committee and served in the FCC's Wireline Competition Bureau as well. Prior to that, he clerked for Judge Sutton on the United States Court of Appeal for the Sixth Circuit. So thank you both for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
Yep,
and I'm going to kick it off. We had a big news flash about an hour ago. The FCC released the results of its first of its kind incentive auction. So the rare example of an idea that sort of was born in a think tank and ultimately found its way into legislation, and the FCC has now implemented it very successfully. Nick, you want to talk a little bit about what the incentive auction is and what the results mean for the future of wireless in the United States?
Absolutely, Brian. And as you know, of course, we timed the closing of the incentive auction to make sure it would happen on the same day as this teleforms, but we could talk about that primarily and more than other things. So the broadcast incentive auction is actually one of the few times in recent history, at least, the FCC has looked to try to really do something different and try to use market forces to solve hard problems. In this case, we had the television spectrum bands, so good old channels 2 through about 51, that were out there and being used by TV broadcast stations. But there are lots of holes in the middle of there. So you might have something on channels 4 and 6, but nothing on 5, or you might have something on channels 31 and 32, but nothing on 33 through 36. And so what some of the economists thought of was, well, look, this is a kind of perfect situation to bring in market forces. Wireless carriers like T-Mobile desperately want new spectrum opportunities so that they can compete in the market. This low-band spectrum is especially good for penetrating buildings and carrying over long distances. And so and then some of these broadcast TV stations, they're up there on the air, but they may not be really using the spectrum for all it's worth. So let's see if we can come up with a way to get the TV stations to give up some spectrum and let the wireless carriers purchase it and maybe help reduce the deficit a little bit in the interim. And so that's what the FCC did. After Congress passed a bipartisan Spectrum Act back in 2012, FCC came up with some rules, adjusted those rules as we kind of learned a little bit more about how to make things actually make sense in the auction. And we sold about $19 billion worth of spectrum, and we have to pay broadcasters about $10 billion to vacate that spectrum, resulting in about a $7 billion payment to the U.S. Treasury to reduce the debt.
Well, first, congratulations. You're the rare government agency that returns money to the FISC, so that's exceedingly well done. And who were the big winners today? I believe that was revealed, right?
Yeah, so today was revealed a lot more of the specifics in terms of what companies won in the auction. T-Mobile was the biggest winner. They bought about $8 billion worth of spectrum, 1,500 licenses. Dish and Comcast were also big winners, between them spending another about $8 billion. And then other companies like AT&T had smaller purchases there, U.S. Cellular as well. So, you know, one of the exciting things for, you know, those of us in the telecom industry in particular is, you know, there's always this concern, at least in some quarters, that this is not a competitive market. And that the big guys, especially AT&T and Verizon, are just going to buy up everything. But, of course, here the exact opposite happened. When you put the spectrum out there, T-Mobile, Dish, Comcast, Dish and Comcast are you know, just starting to enter the wireless market. And it just shows to us how competitive this market is, how much demand there is out there to be in this business, and that free market principles really can generate some good policy outcomes.
And $7 billion for the Treasury.
$7 billion for the Treasury, that's right.
Tricia, when you look at the incentive auction and you have a lot of international experience, how does something like this, where the United States has you know, deployed this tool, this market-based tool, as Nick just described it, in a way that's never been done before, what does it mean in terms of our global positioning and the likelihood that other countries will follow our lead, et cetera?
It's huge. I don't do that accent well, but it is very huge. And this was an issue that the FCC has been talking in the international community about for several years, because as Nick mentioned, this was authorized by Congress in 2012. And a little shout out to Nick. He was actually detailed, I think, from the FCC at the time. So he worked on the legislation. Now he's full circle. He got to be there when it was actually finalized. So congratulations, Nick, again on that. But yeah, this is a big issue because, the FCC, as part of the U.S. team that does go over to international negotiations, of course, likes to promote harmonization of spectrum for economies of scale, for which helps the U.S. consumer. So they had been urging folks around the world to look at 600 megahertz, where the auction was held. That's the low band spectrum where all the broadcasters have been historically, really since the service really got up and running globally. But it, as Nick somewhat intimated, there was more spectrum than today's technology really is needed, right? And so the FCC, in its wisdom, thought, well, this can be repurposed for mobile broadband, because as we all know, the demand for mobile devices, for both for video and for all the myriad applications, is growing, and that phenomenon is global. So the U.S. has been asking other countries to look at 600 to allocate that for mobile broadband services. We didn't get too many takers this last World Radio Conference, which concluded about a year and 3 months ago. But I think with this very successful incentive auction, at the next cycle, we will certainly get a little more interest, and I suspect the U.S. will be asking more countries. We had a couple countries in our region sign on for mobile broadband in the 600 band, and I think after this, we'll get more. The Europeans have been looking at it, but very slowly. And back to your earlier point, Brian, about how this idea came out of a think tank, and it was discussed over different administrations, Republican and Democrat, conservative and liberal. It takes a while, but no other country really has those that ecosystem of think tanks and discussion groups and such an active Congress as well as a regulator. So I do think this is historic. It's the first globally. I think it will have a lot of impact, and it will slowly but surely get more countries looking at 600 megahertz, that broadcast spectrum, for mobile broadband, and that will only benefit U.S. consumers over the long haul through global economies of scale.
Excellent. So the incentive auction is just one of many things that is going on at the FCC these days. And we in the communications sector are very lucky to have had a situation where then-Commissioner Pai was sort of a chairman in waiting upon President Trump's election, and we were able to get a permanent chair, a permanent leader with a clear vision of what he wanted to accomplish with the agency right out of the box. And Nick, you've been there with Commissioner Pai and now Chairman Pai for a number of years now. I think we're on our, 5 years now, 4 or 5 years. When you think about what the priorities should be for the new administration, can you talk about what you view those priorities are as sort of a writ large, and obviously with a focus on the FCC, but more broadly as well?
Sure. I mean, so, you know, I think Chairman Pai has been very clear. His number one priority is closing the digital divide. He comes from Parsons, Kansas, a pretty small town in southeast Kansas. As he likes to joke, the big city nearby was Pittsburgh, but not Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Missouri, which, you know, most of us who are from the coast probably never even heard of, which is unfortunate because it's actually very lovely, and I've been there with him. So for him, it's, you know, all too often there are places of America where broadband still isn't available, or it's available only to a few select locations, and that's really a problem because, you know, it is small-town America, it's rural America, where there are lots of people who are ready, willing, and able to learn how to live independently from government, trying to figure out how to make their lives work, take risks, create social capital, do all the things that you kind of want from an upstanding citizenry. But if they don't have access to broadband, it makes it much harder for them to participate in the 21st century economy. And what we've seen is that areas that we do have broadband can lead to tremendous economic growth. So, for example, we visited a very small town called Diller, Nebraska. And because of a broadband connection, what was originally just a deer processing plant has become a full jerky processing plant that has sales to Whole Foods, to the PGA Tour. They create jerky called Epic Jerky that's actually relatively well-known amongst those who like jerky types. And you have people actually commuting from the cities in Nebraska down to Diller to work, which, you know, broadband helps enable. Now, how do we actually get there? Well, that goes into a kind of a more broader vision I think the chairman has across the board for the economy and especially for the digital economy, which is really removing regulatory barriers both to investment and to innovation. So at the FCC, you know, some of the things we've been looking at, well, what are the various things that government does that make it harder for companies to invest, to build out broadband, to put, you know, new fiber in the ground or put new conduits in the ground in order to hold that fiber or to make those last mile connections? And then also, what are we doing that's impeding innovation in the marketplace? And one example here is there's a new business model that people have been moving towards in the wireless space, the free data model, where you have things like T-Mobile's Music Freedom, which, because they're able to do these kind of private deals that create more efficiencies in the system, they can offer consumers free data usage so that you don't have to have, for example, music streaming count against your annual or your monthly cap. Allowing companies to kind of experiment in there, figure out what works in the market, and letting consumers choose what they really like and what they don't like, that's kind of a return to the permissionless innovation that used to be the hallmark of the internet that unfortunately kind of went away for the past 6 or 7 years or so under the prior administration. So really reducing those regulatory barriers, allowing companies to compete in the market, that's his overall regulatory vision and certainly how he sees the path of the United States to close the digital divide.
And one program, there obviously has been lots of talk over the years about closing the digital divide from all quarters, and different people offered different types of solutions. How do you see universal service fitting into that equation?
Well, sure. I mean, so this is actually one of the things that's kind of amazing. So the chairman was a staffer here back in 2007 when I joined the FCC as well, and most people back then knew that there was going to probably need to be some kind of reforms to the universal service program, in order to close the digital divide. And it's not like we didn't have money. Every time that you pay your cell phone bill, your phone bill, you'll see a little universal service fee on there, and that's a tax collected by the FCC that goes back into these programs. But for years and years, those programs were just designed to pay for telephone networks. Finally, in 2011, the FCC, on a unanimous bipartisan basis, said, no, we got to move forward with this. We got to fix this and have to focus on broadband, which took a lot of work and effort, and they laid out a plan for how to move forward with that, which is fantastic. And then that program largely kind of sat on the shelf. It was not a priority, unfortunately, under the prior administration. And so what's called the Connect America Fund, which was proposed back then as a reverse auction, again, using market-based mechanism to distribute this funding that we already have collected out there to try to improve the quality of service, the higher speed get the higher speed broadband out to rural America, it sat there, and it sat there. And Chairman Pai repeatedly tried to get his colleagues to focus on it, and unfortunately, it just was not a priority before. So, I mean, as you know, Brian, during Chairman Pai's first month in office in February, he actually scheduled and we got a vote on the Connect America Fund, and he's pulled together a task force of economists, attorneys, and others, the Rural Broadband Auctions Task Force, the FCC, to talk to our best economists and figure out exactly how to run this auction and how to get it off the ground as soon as possible, because we already have about $2 billion ready for that, another $4.5 billion ready for advancing 4G LTE into rural America. But instead of actually going out and distributing it and figuring out a way to get it out there, it's just been sitting, and that's been a real problem and why he's made it a priority to fix that.
And just one more question on that. What is your biggest worry as you approach the digital divide issues going forward? What are you most concerned about not having either the legislative authority to do, or are there things outside your control that you're worried about, demand? Where's your biggest gap to concerns?
Sure. There are always lots of concerns. I think the biggest concern is just getting it done, frankly, and making sure that we're doing it as quickly as possible. Because it's been 8 years since deployment has really been a priority for the federal government. It's been 8 years since we've really looked at trying to reduce those regulatory barriers. And I will tell you, from all the rural Americans I've spoken with that don't have broadband yet, it's been far too long enough. And so my biggest concern isn't whether we have the authority. We know we have a lot of authority that we just haven't exercised before. And it's not whether we need to change in terms of how we're approaching it. It's just actually getting everything done and crossing all the I's, or dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's, because we've just had this wait for so long, and I don't think Americans are going to want to wait for that much longer for it to happen.
Tricia, you served on the transition team, and you've been an observer of these issues for quite some time. What should the priorities be in your mind as the new administration looks at these issues?
Well, when you say administration, the lawyer in me thinks just the executive branch. We have to underscore that the FCC is an independent body, right? And its authority actually is delegated from the Congress, specifically from the Commerce Committees, where Nick and I once served. So, I got to underscore that for our audience.
I was going to say, you're going Homer on that. Very well.
And I think the administration's policies, as we've already heard, from folks within the White House, from the president himself, do align with Chairman Pai's priorities, but, kind of at a higher level. Obviously, the president had talked about bringing jobs back, trying to, boost the manufacturing base. And so I think he and his people definitely get the importance of having broadband infrastructure out there to help bring, jobs back, to help, support entrepreneurialism and have some more job creation in innovative areas. So I think, I don't think you're going to see kind of the same degree of micromanagement on telecom policy that we had in the last administration, from the White House. But I think their higher level economic policies, dovetail very well with the FCC's. And on a kind of corollary point, when you asked Nick what's he afraid of in terms of not having sufficient authorization or authority under the statute, Again, for your audience, I think most people would say who watch the FCC closely, the prior FCC didn't really care too much about what authority they had. They kind of took the ball and ran with it. You know, a lot of social engineering, a lot of policy engineering, whether or not they had any authority whatsoever. And for folks like me and perhaps you, Brian, and all our Federal Society members, it is a relief to see a chairman who is very comfortable about staying between the lines and actually giving up authority that his predecessors grabbed from other agencies, and you know, which resulted in duplicative, you know, regulation or several agencies regulating the same economic activity, which of course adds costs, decreases jobs. So I think it's very refreshing that we have a chairman at the FCC who, you know, wants to focus on improving broadband, you know, within the authority. And as well, we all know there's plenty of stuff on the table. I think both the chairman, as he's mentioned, and this administration will focus on, you know, spectrum repurposing, on, you know, 5G, fifth generation wireless broadband policies. I think that both the chairman and administration folks have talked about the importance of U.S. leading on the fifth generation of wireless, which is both, you know, faster broadband speeds, kind of, you know, new faster apps, both critical communications, but as well as, you know, Internet of Things. So it's, I think the priorities is, or interest areas that the administration have you know, talked about in telecom nicely dovetail kind of at the higher macroeconomic level with what the FCC is doing within its authority.
So, you know, can you talk a little bit about what the transition team actually did? And also, there was a lot of discussion about FCC reform as part of the transition team's work. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it fits in with the, you know, the chairman's recent announcement about the creation of a Bureau of Economics, or I guess a task force to study the creation of a Bureau of Economics?
Yeah, so the transition team was tasked with coming up with an action plan, you know, with recommendations on, you know, how the agency should run. And this was done across the board with, you know, all the departments. I mean, every department, every agency had a transition team, you know, to work on this. Now, you know, again, since I have worked both at the FCC, I've worked in the executive branch, I worked up on the Hill, I think I kind of understood my role there in that, you know, the FCC is an independent agency. So, you know, and I knew we had a chairman ready who would be a great man to lead the FCC permanently. So, you know, there were recommendations on how the FCC should function, and including a stronger emphasis on economics and really analyzing cost benefit of regulation. And, you know, the FCC was going to do that, I feel, on their own. So, you know, again, I think the recommendations were, I think perhaps Nick can respond to whether they felt they were helpful. But, you know, my sense going in was that Chairman Pai would know how to run his agency. And, you know, I think we've shown her. His actions have shown that he has. My focus, because my area is more on the international side, was really on streamlining some of the unnecessary reporting requirements. And I was very pleased that one of the first things the chairman did was propose eliminating some of the unnecessary rules that date back from, you know, decades ago when the world was a very different place, the market was very different. Yeah, and he's proposed eliminating some of the the international traffic and revenue reports, some of the cable capacity reporting. So my focus as a practitioner in the bar and having worked there was really more on, okay, these sets of rules you don't need. They do nothing but raise carriers' costs, and, you know, they're great for lawyers like me, but, you know, they're great for the few FCC employees who've been doing them for decades but really don't help, you know, broadband get deployed or the world be a better place. So my focus really was on getting rid of rules that aren't necessary. But I'll leave it at that, and maybe Nick can respond how closely they're going to adhere to our recommendations.
Yeah, I mean, Nick, FCC reform, I guess, Nick, as well as sort of general regulatory, I mean, you guys, as Tricia just alluded to, you have a very strong agenda on getting rid of unnecessary regulatory burdens, but maybe talk about that as well as the agency structure and whether it fits the current marketplace realities.
Sure. So, you know, there's obviously a lot we could talk about here, Brian, and it kind of goes all over the place. But yeah, I mean, just some little things just to start with. So two of the first things that we've done at the agency is we went through what's called the Part 32 accounting requirements, as well as some of the international reporting requirements. And some of this is pretty amazing. Basically, under the Part 32 accounting requirements, we were requiring large carriers to keep two separate books of their accounts, one for all the financial guys who actually look at them on a regular basis, and then another for the FCC, which basically haven't taken a look at those books in about a decade. And even if you go back then, it was not for every carrier that we looked at it. It was just every once in a while. We couldn't find one within the last decade where we've actually looked at this stuff. But we were still requiring carriers to do this. And as you can imagine, what this basically requires is two sets of accountants, two sets of compliance officers, and then a constant concern that you're putting the wrong information in the wrong column or in the wrong set of books, so that you always have additional compliance and oversight required, costing companies literally tens of millions of dollars a year for no benefit whatsoever to the public. Similar on the international accounting reports. You know, we collect two different types of data here. One is just about what are the underwater cables that we have, the undersea cables that are out there, and that's pretty important information. But then we were also collecting from over 1,000 carriers, I believe, all the little bits of information about how much traffic they have, what routes they take, the revenue that they report, tens of millions of dollars, again, in additional burden hours. And the ultimate result of all these reports was basically to repeatedly say, yes, the undersea, transatlantic, transpacific, transarctic routes are all competitive, again and again and again. So not exactly the most useful information now that we already know that it's out there. And we'd also learned that basically even when there were problems over a particular route, this information was never enough to actually solve the problem. And we would always get more particular information from the carriers directly at a much lower cost. So just taking a look at those and starting to apply a little bit of cost-benefit analysis to the FCC's regulations has really been a high priority for Chairman Pai. And then that does feed over into structure. So at the agency right now, we have economists kind of scattered throughout in some of the bureaus and offices. We then also have what's called the Office of Strategic Planning, which is a little bit like an FCC think tank. And then we have a few different divisions or others within the bureaus where you have clusters of economists doing work together and analyzing data. And although this is certainly one way to run an agency, it does make it a little bit hard to ensure that we're actually doing a rigorous cost-benefit analysis before we're imposing regulations, rather than, as the prior administration was wont to do, pass the regulations and then decide afterwards how do you justify that under a cost-benefit analysis. And so what Chairman Pai has proposed doing, and he's pulling together a working group to do it, is creating an Office of Economics and Data at the FCC that would pull together a lot of these resources and ensure that we're looking at economics every step of the way. And that goes from when we're dealing with first proposing rules to adopting them, when we're considering paperwork burdens to when we're hopefully eliminating them. And then also looking at, you know, how do you ensure that these rules, which may make sense for a large carrier, aren't actually affecting small carriers in a way that they can't handle? Because that's what most people don't realize. The ISP market, the telephone market, is hugely competitive. We have literally thousands of different companies trying to provide service in this country, and some of them are just mom-and-pop shops with literally two people, the mom and the pop, in there trying to do everything. And then to ask them to also comply with rules that are really designed for a corporate, much, much larger corporation, doesn't really make that much sense. So hopefully when we have an Office of Economics and Data stood up, we'll have a more rigorous analysis of what we're doing rather than just kind of look kind of reverting back to more political or symbolic decision making.
So I want to open it up to questions from our audience in a moment. So I want to give a preview for our audience, our listeners, to get those questions queued up. But I'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about one of Nick's favorite topics, and that is the open internet docket. One of the signature accomplishments, I think by their own words, of the last administration was the promulgation of open internet rules and reclassification of broadband internet access service as a Title II common carrier service. As legacies go, how would you grade that legacy, Nick? And also, what do you think the right answer is? And Trisha, I'll just ask you to comment after Nick gives his view.
Well, so Brian, yeah, as you know, this is obviously a very hot topic. So I'm going to pretty much try to stick to my lane here. The chairman has repeatedly said since he became chairman that he does believe in a free and open internet, and he opposes Title II. For those who are not deeply in the telecom weeds, Title II, of course, is the 1930s-esque utility-style regulation, which basically allows the FCC to command and control common carriers or pretty much anybody currently who's a telephone company or even an internet service provider. And that's certainly not what the Clinton administration put in place on a bipartisan basis when they first really opened up the internet to commercial use back in the 1990s. And that's not how the internet has grown up. You know, honestly, Brian, I can go on and on forever. Literally 67 pages of information I have I could share with you.
maybe that's not quite necessary. But from a, you know, for our listeners' perspective, what is it that what would be different about an open internet under a Title I approach versus an open internet? What is the how is the consumer experience going to be different under Chairman Pai's vision of how this works versus how it's worked to date?
Well, so again, I have to be very careful here to stay in my lane exactly, but I can tell you that what we had heard from providers and consumers was that there weren't major problems before the commission reclassified the internet as a Title II service. We didn't see things like, you know, unlawful blocking or throttling out there. They weren't real concerns. There were all these ephemeral concerns about hypothetical things that could someday happen if the big bad broadband providers just decided suddenly to not act in the way that they had historically been acting. And you also then have a host of small providers all coming in and basically saying that, you know, with Title II reclassification, we're going to have to pull back investment. And that's largely what we've seen in the marketplace. There's been much more hesitancy to introduce new business models, to invest in new facilities than there was before. And so, you know, from my perspective, I think from a consumer perspective, the question is, well, what do you really want? Do you want heavy-handed government regulation, or do you want better, cheaper, faster internet access? And I know where Commissioner Pai squarely stands.
Well, and that's an interesting one, too. You touched earlier on T-Mobile's music freedom, which was put arguably at risk under the old rules or certainly other creative pricing models, which would have prevented consumers from getting free stuff, and that was one of the negative consequences. Trish, what do you think? The other potential negative consequences were to the existing regime, and then also, how do you feel like the commission should move in the months ahead?
Well, Nick had mentioned it earlier in terms of permissionless innovation, right? And what happened once the FCC reversed course? And just to remind our listeners, for years, kind of how to deal with this, you know, ephemeral threat has been bandied about. And there were internet principles under the Bush 43 administration. The prior chairman had a list of, you know, policies, and the possibility of Title II was discussed up on the Hill. But even the leading Democrats didn't want to go there, and Title II being common carrier. And again, common carrier in its initiation, right, was applied to monopolies. So we're not even talking that you're the big, bad, you know, provider, but, you know, for monopolies. But the so the impact I saw in some instances was that operators and, you know, providers, ISPs, they didn't know quite if what they were going to do was permissible anymore after the FCC switched the rules up and said, okay, all of a sudden, instead of being a information service like Title I, you're now a common carrier. And, you know, we've even though the decision was, you know, thousands of pages, about 6 inches of printed material, it still wasn't very clear in terms of if a particular business arrangement like a binge on with T-Mobile was permissible, right? So you know, and the FCC said, well, come on in, you can talk to us, and we'll tell you if it's, you know, if it's permissible. And of course, nobody with good lawyers is going to let, you know, their client go in and on those discussions, right? So I think it really did chill new innovative offerings that, you know, obviously would have benefited the consumer. So I think it, there are many, certainly the ISPs, I think, are looking for a reversion back to a more, you know, innovative path for internet services. And I'd remind our folks here on the listening in, that open internet or net neutrality was one of the very few telecom issues that President Trump did mention during the campaign. So I think, you know, he had heard about it. You know, he understood that this was kind of, you know, not business friendly to try to set up a regulator who's going to micromanage what new opportunities you want to give your consumers. So we'll see if that moves forward. Obviously, the president did sign the Congressional Review Act, which reversed the FCC's decision to apply more onerous privacy regulations on the ISPs under the new Title II classification. So he, you know, he's comfortable enough with that. Obviously, there were, in my view, a lot of distortive reaction by folks on that, since there weren't even ISP broadband privacy rules in place. So it wasn't as if consumers were all of a sudden having to deal with a different set of conditions. But, you know, so there was a lot of breathless angst expressed in various corners. So I think there'll probably be a little pause. Nick knows better than I on as to when they might move forward on that. But as Nick mentioned, and many folks have seen a diminution in some of the investment, and obviously that's a problem. So that needs to be rectified to be consistent with, well, both the chairman and the president's interest in, you know, growing the economy, creating new jobs, creating new business opportunities.
Well, Mr. Dugani, let me throw one more at you. So April is infrastructure month at the FCC. You've got an aggressive agenda coming up. And can you talk a little bit about why infrastructure is so important to the chairman, and how do we put these new initiatives, which maybe you can tell our audience a little bit about, into a larger context?
Well, so absolutely, Brian. I mean, so this a little bit goes back to the idea of closing the digital divide. But, you know, there's a basic kind of working theory in our office, which is that if you lower the cost of entry, then there's going to be more competitive entry into a market. And if you lower the cost of deployment, then you're going to have greater deployment across the country. So you're going to get faster, better, cheaper broadband out to areas that don't have it now, and more competitive options out to areas that have fewer competitive options now. That's the kind of basic working theory. And, you know, the nice thing is that it's only based in, you know, actual real-world experience and economics and basic business theory. So that's really what we're going for here is let's actually look at what are the economists, what do economics, what do the businesses say cause them to hold back investment or make investment, and let's try to reduce those costs. And so, you know, one thing we've seen, and it's been really fun going out here and traveling parts of America, but one thing we've seen in, like, Louisiana, Chairman Pai actually was able to sit on what's called a ditch witch, where they were actually pushing conduit through the muck of the bayous in order to string new fiber there. And we heard stories there and throughout the country of cities and municipalities, you know, asking for large sums of money to be able to have the right to actually put up fiber on a pole, or saying that, well, we're going to make you wait 12 months before we decide on whether we're going to grant you a permit. Or, you know, in San Francisco, we've heard stories of companies basically coming up with new innovative ways, like using chicken wire, because they were otherwise not allowed to actually put up antennas that are no larger than a small desktop computer, or even sometimes no larger than a small laptop computer, in order to get better Wi-Fi service. And that's really ridiculous. You know, everybody in this country, I think, wants better, faster, cheaper broadband. We need to lower the cost. We need to speed up the timeline for getting it out there. And that's exactly what we've teed up in these infrastructure items. Again, just to take another example of what we've seen out there, you know, right now we have these historic preservation rules, and unfortunately those rules don't often make the most sense. And so there are situations where historic preservation officers are required to come in and basically monitor the deployment of what are called small cells, so very small things, again, maybe the size of a small rotary phone, and putting them on lampposts outside of already built-up areas. And that apparently has historic preservation concerns. And I'll tell you, as a consumer, that sounds ridiculous to me. Why is a company having to spend thousands of dollars to make sure that attaching something to a pre-existing lamppost, possibly a pre-existing lamppost in a parking lot, does not affect historic artifacts that don't seem to be present there already, because we already have a parking lot and a lamppost there. That seems crazy to me, and that's one of those things that's just a utterly needless barrier that raises the cost for all carriers, which ultimately is just going to raise the cost of service and reduce the amount of competitive entry we have in the space.
Thank you, Nick. I am curious, is there a picture of the chairman using the Ditch Witch? Because that seems like that'd be a keepsake. That we're
actually, so we took several pictures of him during that trip, posted them. I think he tweeted them all out. And then the Washington Post even took the four or five of them together and strung it into a little story. So
very good. I will look it up. I missed the Ditch Witch pictures. I can't believe it. So with that, Dean, we have some callers that would like to ask a question of our panel.
Plenty of people on the line. Let me open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we get started, I'll make a quick commercial announcement, and that is our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern time at this same number, when we'll be talking about the CFPB. It's a regular update our financial services practice group experts give on the latest goings-on at the CFPB. I've got to suggest that maybe Chairman Pai's venture on the Ditch Witch probably violated some labor law, some union rule or something. but I don't want to stir up any trouble. So I'm not asking a question officially. We've got a couple callers with questions. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call.
Hi. I was kind of worried about deregulating these ISPs because they are largely a course of monopolies or duopolies because of the local governments. For example, here out in Suffolk County, the county made it very difficult for Cablevision to get their wires up, and the phone company just went around it because they already had the right to put wires up. And so we have two suppliers of wired ISPs or fiber optic ISPs, and that gives them a course of monopoly position because it's very hard for anybody else to compete with them. But you indicated that the FCC regs made it even more difficult, especially when there were so many thousands of pages or whatever, to get into to even think about getting into competing with them. So is there any way we can deal with these locals, local governments, that would make it easier to have a more competitive environment that would provide better service from the ISPs?
Thank you, sir, for your question. Do you mind identifying yourself?
Chris Garvey.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
Patent attorney.
Excellent. So, you know, Nick, it's interesting with your infrastructure items teed up for the open meeting. I know one of the priorities is making sure to lowering the barriers to investment, particularly on municipal infrastructures, where historically, as Chris points out, there was once a monopoly. You want to touch on some of the initiatives that are in play to open that up for more providers?
Absolutely. And actually, for what it's worth, I'm going to put in a separate plug here. One of the great things about Chairman Pai is he really does believe in transparency. So as Brian is talking about all of these things, Brian doesn't have any kind of inside information about what the FCC is doing or considering this month. It's instead that Chairman Pai, for the first time in FCC history, puts up the things that we're going to be voting on 3 weeks in advance, so the full public has an opportunity to take a look at them. So if you're actually interested, go to FCC.gov. Under our headlines, you'll see basically the full agenda for the month of April and all of his proposals there. And you could look at, for example, the wireline infrastructure item, which is what Brian is talking about. You're absolutely right, Chris, that unfortunately there are too many regulatory barriers at the local level. And so the FCC has a few different tools to combat this. One is just general pole attachments. Now, this is something that's partly regulated by some states, so we don't have full authority over those states. But for the states that don't regulate it themselves, the FCC sets some of the rules for pole attachments, and it does often require far too long in terms of a process for people to move forward. And then right now, if someone doesn't, if a city or a county doesn't actually help things move forward in that pole attachment process, basically things can kind of get stuck, and you're basically stuck there waiting or possibly allowed to go to court or file a complaint at the FCC. Now, I'll tell you, unfortunately, the FCC has not been moving as quickly on complaints for pole attachments as I think we'd like to. And that's certainly something I think the chairman would like to rectify at some point. But in the interim, it's better to also get some additional rules on the road out there, what you're allowed to do, how you can attach more quickly without necessarily having to first file a complaint at the FCC. In terms of permitting and other things, we have another section of the Communications Act 253, which prohibits municipalities and other governments from imposing particular barriers to entry into the telecom space. And so that's another thing that we could be using and looking at, and we are looking at, to look at some of the potentially excessive fees that cities and states are charging or their permitting processes that might be additionally slow, restricting competitive entry into those areas. And then finally, you know, Chairman Pai also believes not just in voluntary cooperation amongst the public and industry and others, but also amongst governmental actors. And so last September, he proposed his digital empowerment agenda, one portion of which was the Gigabit Opportunity Zones idea. And as part of that, he had proposed that the FCC would form a broadband deployment advisory committee to take a look at creating model codes for states and for cities to show how they could lower some of these barriers and induce additional entry and additional broadband deployment in those areas. Well, the very cool thing, of course, is that Chairman Pai is now the chairman, and so he has stood up the Broadband Deployment Advisory Committee, which will have its first meeting on April 21st, and their top responsibility is to look at this exact issue and make recommendations and seeing if we can come up with a model code for states and for municipalities, which we would hope we could urge them to adopt, and hopefully Congress might be able to help urge them to adopt as well in order to get these lower barriers or these regulatory barriers gone and more deployment out there.
That sounds fabulous, but I wonder if it raises federalism concerns in that local governments usually have the ability to extract as many bribes and erect as many barriers as they want.
Well, so there are certain, I mean, there are certain federal restrictions to the extent that these are interstate services being offered. That was the 253 that I talked about before. So there are certain reasonable limits in terms of what cities and municipalities are allowed to do. Certainly there are some federalism concerns with that. But thus far, you know, and we're going to stay obviously within the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. Congress has made clear that this is a national priority and exercise the Interstate Commerce Clause preemption in order to make sure that local barriers don't prevent the deployment of these interstate services like broadband. But more broadly, that's exactly why you also look at the voluntary model, because if there are ways to do a more kind of cooperative federalism, get the municipalities, get the states to the table, then you don't have to worry about any kind of legal constraints in terms of what the federal government or what the FCC can or cannot do, because, of course, it's not us doing it in that circumstance. Instead, the states or the municipalities voluntarily saying, yes, we want our citizens to have better broadband.
And I guess this is a much better argument for interstate commerce than, for example, planting too much corn on your own land.
Exactly. I would certainly hope so.
Thank you, Chris. Let's, Dean, we can move to another question.
We do have one question pending. After that, our lines are wide open. If you'd like to join the queue, we've got about 10 minutes left. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yes, Alden Abbott from Heritage Foundation. Just curious as to whether anyone wanted to comment about possible future cooperation between Chairman Pai and the Federal Trade Commission. I know Acting Chairman Olhausen and Chairman Pai had a very helpful statement on March 1st dealing with approaches to privacy. Is there any contemplated additional cooperation on topics such as the Internet of Things, technology developments, economics of the Internet, and so forth? Hello.
So I'm going to jump in on that one. And can I just geek out for a second? Is this the Alden Abbott who also contributes to Truth on the Market?
It is.
Ha! Well, I've read a bunch of your blogs. I really appreciate all the work you're doing out there. So thank you.
Thank you.
In terms of your question, though, I can tell you Chairman Pai has a close relationship with Acting Chairman Olhausen. We're in constant contact with them to figure out exactly what the best way is to move forward on, frankly, a variety of issues, whether it's privacy or general antitrust authority and competition policy, or just trying to figure out how to crack down on other issues like robocalls, which is a joint concern of both the FCC and the FTC. So I can't break confidences and talk about any particular plans that we might have, but I can say that we both of our agencies are very much committed to working together to try to solve these problems for the American consumer within the strict bounds of our authority.
And I'll just add, as a third-party observer, I mean, nothing would inspire that kind of trust than one regulator giving back to the other regulator authority over an area of activity. I mean, certainly I think that would strengthen the bond, so there must be even more trust built up between the two since Chairman Pai happily gave back authority over, you know, ISP broadband privacy.
And I would be remiss if I didn't observe that one of the many negative impacts of reclassification of broadband as a utility or as a common carrier service was that it did pull it within the common carrier exemption of the FTC's jurisdiction. So the prior administration effectively took the FTC off the beat as a cop on a bunch of broadband practices, and many of the proposals that have traditionally been favored by Chairman Pai and others would put the FTC back on the beat. And that's, I think, important for the sector, and also there's no reason to have a sector-specific regulator when it comes to things like broadband, like privacy, as Tricia just pointed out. Instead, it just promotes confusion. So I think there's a lot of key elements of cooperation, not only in terms of the traditional consumer protection piece, but also the larger, some of the initiatives that Chairman Pai and Chairwoman Olhausen are working on together. So do we have another call, Dean?
We do. Let's move right to our next caller.
This is Chris Garvey again, and that just slipped my head. Sorry, take the next caller.
Do that.
While you're queuing up the next caller, I will note that on the local municipal siting issue, there is a lot of work in industry and trying to come up with, you know, better arguments and analysis of the benefit to cities and counties and towns of having broadband infrastructure. So, and, you know, obviously the local governments, they want control, to Chris's earlier federalism point, but and, you know, obviously in our system they should have some control over their, they should obviously have control over their infrastructure. However, you know, I think if the benefits of, you know, the economic benefits to their populace of having, you know, greater speeds in their cities, having, you know, more industrial internet opportunities, you know, can be made, we're going to have a better conversation. So it's a multi-party discussion, and I'm very pleased that Chairman Pai has really created a forum to have it.
Well, Brian, this is Dean. I don't see a next question if you want to take the final question of the day for yourself.
All right. So maybe for Tricia and for Nick, we'll start with Tricia. Tricia, what is the hidden issue that maybe our callers or listeners are not aware of as we approach the first year of this administration, that it's going to be a big issue in telecom and tech policy that maybe people aren't talking about enough from where you sit?
Well, from where I sit, they're talking about it. But I do think the importance of getting more spectrum repurposed from federal government use to private sector, or, you know, commercial or shared commercial and government use, will be controversial. I mean, to give the federal government its due, its credit, they have freed up a number of different bands over the last couple of years. It's always a difficult process. But I do think just because of the length of time it's taking to get people into their political positions, and this is no fault of the president or the White House, it's Washington, quarter one, 2017, that the in that policy vacuum, the government agencies are currently have the upper hand in not really being forthcoming with new bands that could be repurposed. And we talked about the incentive auctions early on. That's low band spectrum. It has great propagation. The waves travel very far. They go through walls. But with the Internet of Things, with the densification of networks coming from with faster broadband in urban markets, the more high band frequencies, what we call millimeter wave frequencies, could be used. The industry has really spent a lot of research and research money working, and this is a global phenomenon, working on using those upper bands. And those upper bands aren't terribly used, but because the industry hasn't been really using them, you know, government has allocations there, and perhaps, you know, some systems, perhaps not as many as they claim. Anyway, that's going to be a very difficult decision or discussion to get more spectrum freed up, you know, until we have all our policy folks in place. So, you know, that's going to be a challenge. So we hope we can make some progress this year on that.
All right, Nick, 30 seconds on a final challenge. Underappreciated.
Sure. I mean, so this is actually not, I'm not going to say challenge, just kind of sleeper issue, I think, is just the return to the rule of law in telecom policy. You know, it was pretty amazing, pretty breathtaking, the lack of awareness of the constraints on the FCC and the federal government under the prior administration, and the lack of caring. I mean, I'll tell you, I've never known an administration before that's been stayed four separate times in a single proceeding by the D.C. Circuit, but that happened to the FCC. I've never known an administration where literally no one in the building thought the FCC had a legal leg to stand on. This is in the Muni Broadband case. But the agency decided to move ahead with it because why not? What does it matter what the Supreme Court says? Maybe we'll get a different set of judges this time. And so it's one of the things as a lawyer that I just really appreciate about Chairman Pai is that we're looking at an agency that really does care about what the law says and making sure that we are not trying to just do whatever it is that we want to do, but trying to show our proper respect for law and for the laws that Congress has actually signed, not just the laws that we wish they would sign. And that's going to be a big change for telecom policy, I think.
Excellent. I'm going to offer my own. I think it's good. Cybersecurity is going to be our big one. It's not necessarily an FCC, but I think we're going to have some serious challenges in the coming year that we probably don't fully anticipate even as we sit here today. But with that, I want to thank Tricia and Nick for a great conversation this afternoon. And thank you, Dean, as always, for pulling us all together for this teleforum. And I wish everyone a great afternoon. I'll turn it back to Dean.
Thank you. Let me join in thanking both of those guests and thanking Brian Tramont. It was actually him and the people at WBK that did the lion's share of putting this together. So thank you. I also want to thank the audience for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to the audience that our next scheduled telephone conference call Tuesday at 3 p.m. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.